Change the subject. Yeah, boy, it's nice to be up here and have control up to a point. Okay. Exodus. Now, everybody's got their Bible marked so you know exactly where you're going. What chapter?
Okay.
All right, verse 21, chapter 22, Exodus 22, verse 21. All right, now we're in the middle of all these laws that apply, particularly to the society of that day. Most of them could be adapted for today. At least it would give us some form of guidance for many of the situations we run into. People say that the Bible isn't a book for today. I say some people say that. Yeah. If we could get back to the principles of the Word of God, we might be a lot better off. Verse 21, thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Now, you know, that says a lot more than may appear on the surface. You have a foreigner in your midst, all right? You're not to give him a bad time. The Polish jokes don't go. The wetback jokes don't go. The Hungarians aren't here. We just won't pick on them today. But where do we get them here? nor oppress them. All right? Now, really, what's it saying? It has something to say to the prejudices that seem to be normal amongst human beings. Now, they're there. Now, you know, that word prejudice is not at all a bad word. There isn't a human being that is not prejudiced in one way or the other. Now, let me pick on Alice. I'm not this way at all. But Alice is extremely prejudiced, particularly in relation to our granddaughter. See, you can be prejudiced in favor of something, you see. We have opinions about everything. And Alice seems to think that our granddaughter is absolutely the smartest, the most beautiful in all the world. Now, it happens I have a tendency to agree about it, but I don't say anything about it. Much. Not enough, anyway. All right? But Alice is extremely prejudiced in that direction. She's always willing to talk about her granddaughter. Now, you know, she's not the only one. Several times recently, I'm going down the highway going home, and I read the bumper stickers, and somebody will have a bumper sticker on there that says, ask me about my grandchild, you know? And some of them have CB antennas on. Yes?
You have one advantage. You kept a whole bunch of people that can't talk back.
Quiet. I don't have the floor here. Yeah, that's exactly it, see? No, but what I am trying to say is every human being is, you know, is prejudiced about everything. Now, I don't care what you say. Hamburgers, you have a prejudice either a little bit for or a little bit against. Now, Alice happens to be prejudiced towards hamburgers. I'm prejudiced towards them, too. It's food. I mean, calories. Low-calorie plates and high-calorie plates. I have prejudices in relation to each one. I like them both, I guess. But, no, in all seriousness, colors. Name a color. Some people say blue. Some people favor it a little bit for one reason or another, and some maybe don't like it. Red, green, hot, cold. All right, Alice. She'll drink her soup or her coffee scalding hot. I like it to be hot when I get it, but I want it to cool off to lukewarm. See? She's prejudiced in favor of hot coffee and prejudiced against cold coffee. I'm prejudiced against hot coffee. My lips and tongue, I guess, are too tender. I'm prejudiced in favor of coffee that's been hot and has cooled off a little bit so I can drink it comfortably. Okay? Now, we all have prejudices. Now, it's normal. You know, I guess some preachers would get run out of some modern churches today for saying this. We're all prejudiced towards racial and national and ethnic groups, one way or the other, towards or against. You say Polish, there's an image that forms in your mind. You say Italian, there's an image that forms in your mind. You say Irish, there's an image that forms in your mind. I got a kick. I don't know whether it happened to any of you, but over in Hawaii, a bunch of kids coming down in a truck, and we're at the side of the road. They turned around and yelled, "Redneck!" Now, how about that? Out of Hawaii, see? I had a little feeling about what it might be to be a minority.
That's what they call a Mississippi people.
Yeah, but that's what I got out of a bunch of kids that come by in a truck in Hawaii, and I got kind of a kick out of it, except there was a little burn there for a second. What? You know? The first time I'd ever really been called in my face by a gang, a redneck, see? I've been called some other things, honky and other things, but face the fact that we have these things in us. Now, if you can do that, then you're better able to handle the effects of your prejudice. All right? Yesterday, when we were taking Dave around to look at apartments, we met a young couple, 24 years old. They had both gone to the same high school I went to and graduated from it. And they were telling me the problems they had with certain groups in that high school when they went there, and they were talking about some of those problems were being solved. They have no idea of the problems we had with the Zoot Suiters and some of the other groups, the names, you know, that went around in that same school. They had They had trouble with blacks in that high school about 8 years ago, I guess. They really did. It got to the extreme edge of violence in that particular high school. But when I went there, there was one black boy there. One black boy. And I don't mean that as blacks would normally take it as an insult when you call, because we were all boys and girls, all right? There was one black person there in that high school. And I was kind of fascinated by him because I hadn't seen that many. But there were other dividing lines along racial groups, along the haves and has not. You know, we were coming out of the Depression, and that particular high school had a core of people who had a little bit, and there was a lot of others who didn't. Kids that would drive to school with their Model A Fords, hopped up Model A Fords. You remember those? You go back that far? Sure you do. Rumble seats, right. And you see, what I'm saying is our ideas about people have an effect on the way we live and the way we think. Now, the standards that were in effect when I was in that high school were totally done away with. That they weren't there. And these kids, only to me, kids, 24 years old, young people, 24 years old, were talking about how rough it had been in that same high school with problems that we didn't even dream about. And how they were saying those problems are being solved and the school's coming back up and so forth. I wonder what the next round of problems is going to be. Eventually, they're going to be built around what people think about other groups of people. Okay? I could foresee in the current free society that we live in, where, and the term is a proper term, it's not a cuss word the way I'm using it, where legitimate children will be separated from illegitimate children. I was going to use the other word. I think it might well come to that. Because, you see, we passed through a stage where there have been a lot of births out of wedlock.
Delivered,
yeah. And there's a certain amount of pride, believe it or not, in this flaunting of authority and so forth. And an upcoming generation, apparently, is going back towards a basic moral code. Now, whether it's a lasting thing or not, I don't know. But I think that there could well be problems. It's just one of the possibilities. There may be things that you and I are not even thinking about today that will divide people on the basis of prejudice. Now, this particular verse, and maybe it's staying too long in the verse and saying too much about it, but here we have the Israelites who have just been brought out of a land where they were strangers for 400 years. They were the foreigners in the land of Egypt. And they were put down and trod upon. They were subjected. They came in voluntarily and ended up, after 400 years, as 1 million-plus slaves, probably. Okay? They have come out of the land of Egypt, and they have been separated from the rest of the world. They're out in the midst of this desert, and they exist as a nation. And God's saying, when you have the foreigner, the stranger come in amongst you, watch your racial prejudices. Now, God separated the Jew for a very special purpose, but he didn't separate him to the extent that they had the right to trod underfoot any other peoples. Now, that may bring some objections to mind, because you'll know that sooner or later, God is going to direct these people, this nation, to wipe out other nations. But it's his judgment when he does it. It's not their free will and not their right to pick and choose who they're going to select and who they're going to accept. In this particular instance, he says, when you've accepted a foreigner in your midst, you're not to give a bad time, you're not to oppress him, you're not to make slaves out of him, you're not to oppress him on the basis of who he is and what he is only. In other words, where he comes from. All right, now, there'll be more to say about that as we go along, maybe in another book. Saw some of it this morning in the Sunday school class. Yeah, this says an awful lot there.
And, mm-hmm.
10:19, yeah. There are other places, too, I believe, that go along in the same direction. Now, verse 22. And I kind of get a kick out of some of this. Maybe you don't understand what I'm saying, but let's get into it. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. The widow and the fatherless child. Or fatherless child, or both. If thou... Now, here's where I get the kick out, because God really puts his nose in there. And I like little children. I like little children who have tears in their eyes, who've been kicked around a little bit. I have a special place for them. And I think God has a much more special place, because it sounds almost like he's getting his dander up and giving them a special warning about widows and fatherless children, special people. Because in this instance, he says, if thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear thy cry, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Now, you talk about retribution. It's really not a joking matter, but I see something in here that's very special, because God has taken a special block, and he says, here are my widows and my children, fatherless children, my orphans, they're mine. You give them a bad time, and I'm telling you something. If they cry out to me and call for my help, I'm going to come, and I'm going to come fast. And I'm going to come with the sword, and I'm going to kill you, and I'll make your wives and your children widows and orphans. In effect, he's saying, I'll have more widows and orphans, and I'll watch out for the widows and the orphans. Don't you give them a bad time. A very special little group in God's eyes. And, you know, maybe that should be some comfort to them. I don't know. All right. Verse 25. And if thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as a usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. In other words, you're not to be like a money lender and charge interest. If one of your neighbors nearby you has a need and you feel free to lend him money, then you lend it to him free of interest. You don't put an additional burden on his mind. If he's really got an extreme need, you help. Okay? All right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that could well be, and I know that there are some that make that interpretation, but the word usury means interest, period. It has been used as a word intended to mean extreme interest, all right, high interest. And, you know, we have laws against usury here. There are limits to what you can legally charge in interest and under many circumstances. And if you violate that, then you're violating the laws of usury, right? But the basic meaning of it is charge interest, period. Interest. As a business.
But made those
Now, again, that's one of those situations, what's too much interest? It depends on how badly you need the money and whether you're borrowing or lending. You know, if I deposit my money in the bank, in other words, loan it to the bank, I want as much interest as I can get. If I'm borrowing it from them, I want to, borrowing it back from them, I want to pay as little as I can. Question of viewpoint, right?
See, they trick people. They say, you think you're getting a good deal when they pay 1.5% interest.
Per month.
Yeah. See,
compounded daily.
Yeah. When they figure that up by the year.
Boy, yeah. This is why we have truth in lending. Yeah. But you know, really, with the education that we have available in this country, there should be no need for truth in lending laws. Any grade school student, any early high school student ought to be able to sit down and figure that out rather quickly. Well, I know, I say should be able to. All right? That's another story, isn't it? I don't want to get into that one again. I'll be lost for the rest of the night. Our schools. If thou at all take thy neighbor's raiment for a pledge, thou shalt deliver it unto him by that the sun goeth down. Now, that seems to say, let me finish it. For that is his covering only, it is his raiment for his skin. Wherein shall he sleep? And it shall come to pass, when he crieth unto me, that I will hear, for I am gracious. All right, now what's it saying? I can't see where you would take a person's coat or garment as a pledge, as security, knowing that you can only keep it for the rest of that one day. Now, it may well be that, you know, the only thing I can think of is kind of silly. He wants to buy a hamburger for lunch, and you've got the price for the hamburger for him. So you take his coat for security until he gets home in the evening and brings the money over to your house and pays you for the hamburger. But I would think it was pretty chintzy, you know, if you had to go that route. I can't see very many instances where what you're going to loan or that you're going to need security for is so petty that a coat will cover it. Now, I recognize that some of the coats, the single-piece garments, involved what would amount to a high percentage of earnings. They were expensive. Yeah. But keeping in mind that you can only keep it for the rest of that particular day, what value is it of holding it at all? Well, then.
So then they put down this court, put down this law that if you take them back, you ain't going to take them close.
Well, yeah, but you can take it for part of one day. You got to give it back to him at nighttime. Now, in that case, why didn't he just say you can't take a man's clothes for security? In effect, period. Instead of you can take it, but you got to give it back that particular evening. No, before the sun goes down. Yeah, you got to give it to him by the time he needs it, before it turns cold, before he needs it to cover up with at night. Now, it seems rather strange. I can't think of many instances, but. I would strongly suspect there were circumstances that existed in that day that we don't even think about today that would cover it. Maybe as we go along, we'll see something that sheds some light on it. All right, verse 28. Thou shalt not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of thy people. Okay. Now, my margin says that word gods, singular, should be capitalized and say God. All right? Yet it's recorded in the scriptures here, small g and an s on the end of it. That would say to me that even the false gods of other people, you shouldn't make fun of, you should not curse. Destroy, yes. But... and you should keep away from them. You shouldn't worship them. This we already know. Its place here, if we take it the way it is in the King James Version. Anybody have another version?
The
yeah, read it to me in whatever you've got there.
Verse
28. Singular and capital.
It's in capital.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Curse government officials, your judges, and your rulers.
What did you have?
It's same.
Same. Okay. So there they capitalize it and make it singular, and therefore it is God. Well, we went through that at one time.
You shall not revile the gods. And here it says, you are the gods. I'm not sure what that means. That's what it says.
Well, I think I used this in one area not too long ago, probably in the book of Hebrews, where that we are to be like God and we're to have the power of God at our disposal, prompted and under the control of the Holy Spirit. Now, the bit that applied early in the book of Hebrews when we are positioned just a little lower than God.
Well, would you be saying here, you shall not revile each other?
That would be part of it. Now, there's another factor that may help answer it that came to mind, and that's the fact that the name for God in the Old Testament many times is Elohim, the plural form of God. God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. And we often use this in using the name of God that the Jew accepts and point out that's a plural name, not a singular name. And when they argue against the possibility of the Trinity, the possibility of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, then the plural name of God comes into effect. And if we go back to the first chapter of Genesis, when God, speaking, says, let us make God in our image. Yet, it's one. God is one. So, it could well be, in the translation from the original language, is that particular plural name was noted here and translated to be plural gods, gods in the plural. There may have been some doubt in the minds of the particular translators at this point when this was brought out. The later translations, as been pointed out, goes to God with a capital letter and singular. So we'll accept that, and then the curse the ruler of thy people. Now, again, we mentioned this morning the election coming up, and it doesn't seem like very much. It's a little local state primary with some initiatives on it. The people have a chance to say, hey, existing politician, you're doing either a good job and we want to keep you, and you say it very loudly, or you're doing a bum job and we don't want you and we're going to get rid of you, or you haven't been measuring up quite to standard, but you seem to be about as good as it stays, the shows, and maybe we'll keep you, but you better watch your step. And really, that's the message that I think will go out in this particular lesson, election in the state of California. Coupled with some of the initiatives, I think that the people of California have a chance for a very loud voice. Okay? I think so. I think it'll shake up not only politicians in Sacramento and in the local level, but clear across the nation. I think the whole country is watching to see what happens. And more than that, they'll be watching in months afterwards to see just how far things go and how resolute the people of this particular state are. California does have a position of leadership in setting an example across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, David missed registering by one day. He didn't know how soon it ran out. He's very upset. Okay. Mm-hmm. Verse 29, thou shalt not delay to offer the first fruits of thy ripe fruits and of thy liquors, and the firstborn of thy son shalt thou give unto me. Now I wonder about that word liquors. How would you interpret it? Would you get that out of Scofield Bible, the notes? Well, how does it read in the Amplified, or in the Amplified, or... 29. Where are you?
Hey, wait a minute.
Whoa, completely. You're in the wrong book. Boy, you've been paying attention.
Wait a minute. You must be prompt in giving me the tithe of your crops and your wine and the redemption payment for your oldest son.
Okay. Now.
They had brought liquor and wine.
All right. Wine, liquors.
Yeah, today we call it liquors and wine.
Mm-hmm. Wine and liquors. All right. The subject's got to come up sooner or later, and it does come up periodically in the scriptures. From what I'm able to find, wine for the table and the family, even the kids drank it, and it was fermented enough to preserve. More than that, they had another form of preservation that they called wine, which involved putting the grape of the juice out in the open sun and evaporating it until it became a heavy syrup and very heavily concentrated with sugar, which was a self-preservative. The heavier the concentration of sugar, the better it keeps. And this did not ferment. And it was stored, and again, you get into this business of storing wine in old skins and new skins. Now, a lot of people don't understand the reasoning and think, well, after a year, it gets weak. That's not the point at all. This new wine that was dehydrated and condensed to a syrup could be stored in a new skin, clean skin, that was sown and the wine was put in directly. No contamination, nothing, no growth, sealed, no oxygen. But the second time around, after it had been emptied, mold could start growing. And when the new wine was put in, it could begin to ferment, you get the gas bubbles and it would cause it to burst. Now, that's the meaning behind it all. I'm convinced that because of, one, sanitation, unsanitary water supplies, they did not have the water treatment systems that we have today, and in areas that were just about as heavily populated as you find in a lot of other areas, where they have the need, the absolute need, for modern sanitary water facilities, they had as many people concentrated. And this was one means of being able to have something to drink that necessary, getting your water intake. Not necessarily with water. Drink it. I mean, it's got a water content to start with. But, again, now, when we present something like this, I know who that is, Phil, I'm not going to make it.
What? Good time.
Excuses, like I have done, and I recognize that, for abstinence, and cut out the business of drinking wine and all that. That's not the intent at all. What I am saying is there probably weren't near as many drunks, quote-unquote, around it, in those days as you might think. On the other hand, mildly alcoholic beverages from the grape were commonly drunk in the family, in the home, all over. I would suspect it's like the old 3.2 beer that you got in the service. Unless you were awfully young and hadn't drunk at all, you'd have to drink an awful lot, I mean an awful lot, to get any kind of a high or a drunk or anything else. The content was very low. Enough to preserve and no more. And I'm sure that they were skilled enough in these processes to do it right. On the other hand, we know from the record of the scriptures and history that they let the fermentation go on beyond, and then it became literally hard liquor, very high alcoholic content. You know, they don't have to stop at 12% in manufacturing of wine today. They can bring that percentage quite a ways up higher. You know, if you look at a bottle of wine, I think you'll find anything from 8 to 18% and average around 12. Well, what are you going to say? You can't say that they abstained. You can't say that God taught abstinence. Abstinence is taught from the viewpoint of the Christian testimony, and only from that viewpoint. All right? God doesn't say that wine in itself is wrong. Okay? Now, this is a position that's awfully hard to take, because you're better off to take the position of total abstinence. Paul took that position, and he says, if the world is going to judge you over a drink of wine, or eating of pork, or meats, or anything else, you're better off to abstain from that, so that you don't hurt the testimony that you're about to give in relation to the Lord Jesus Christ. Just let it go. And for that reason, I and many other preachers will preach the necessity for total abstinence in the life and testimony of the Christian. But I can't stand here and say, you have a hard and fast rule, and I can't agree with a hard and fast church rule totally that says a church member cannot have a glass of wine with his dinner. Period. I can't say that, and I won't do it. I will look at that same Christian and say, you're better off not to drink it because that guy sitting across the room or your next door neighbor is going to judge your Christian testimony on the basis of that. And in this day and in this age, you can totally destroy your opportunity to witness for Christ with it. Okay? Now, I mentioned before going in the house, going to visit, particularly in this house where it was a headquarters for a motorcycle gang. And I'd gotten it in through this young man that was injured and in a hospital, and I went to see him. And when they answered the door and somebody says it's a preacher, you look through and you see him shove the bottles of beer back under the sofa, and they fall over and they're running out between their legs. What's the use? I knew what they were doing. I walk in the door. The house is full of it. You can smell it. So who's kidding who and what's the need? Well, they look at the Christian and say, the Christian doesn't drink. The preacher doesn't drink. Now, if I'd sat down and picked up a bottle of beer with them, there's no way on this earth I could have talked to that family and that group. No way. So for that reason, I would encourage total abstinence on the part of the Christian. But I'm not going to say, if you have a bottle of wine in your closet or in your refrigerator, that you're bound for hell and that you're not a Christian. No, I'm just not going to do it. Okay? In fact, if you... On petty little things, yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you a little secret. If you walk...
That written into our bylaws.
Mm-hmm. I know.
It's not scriptural.
Not really. Not really. Well, I'd go slow about changing something that people have set up over the years. I think the things will change naturally. If you went into my house, you would find a bottle of Burgundy and sometimes a bottle of white wine in the refrigerator. And I use it when I cook a steak or a roast. You know the best way to fix a roast, as far as I'm concerned, is take a nice piece of beef, put a package of dried onion soup over the top and a little red wine in the bottom and cover it and put it in for a little while and take the lid off and bake it the rest of the way, and you can't beat that roast. And I'll have it in my house. Sorry about that. If you want to judge me, judge me. It's gone, yeah. Yeah, but see, people look, though. There's wine. Well, you could really knock somebody down on that, couldn't you? Yeah. Well, I think you see what I am saying, this question of judging. Now, liquors here usually would imply hard liquor that you would take with the intent of getting drunk. I mean, you say liquor today, that's whiskey, 90 proof or 100 proof or whatever. You go out and you buy Seagram's whiskey, okay? I can't think of any other names right now, but, you go out and buy the bottle. If you see the preacher carrying that, there's not too many things you're really going to cook with that. And I don't know any recipes. I'll confess right now that I don't know any recipes to use a good Scotch whiskey. What, quote unquote, good Scotch whiskey. So if you see the preacher carrying that out, he's going home to get drunk. All right? So you can judge that. That's what I'm trying to say. Our judgments are going to be, they're always made in a flash. Again, that goes back to what we opened the service with, maybe we ought to close with it today. Prejudices. All right?
You can always go with beer, though, because you can say you're going to wash your hair.
Can we use it for the snails?
Yeah.
I never thought about that one. I sure have got a lot of snails.
I was going to say, pour it in the pan.
Yeah. That's what I've heard.
Work.
I haven't tried. It doesn't work.
Salt.
So salt will do it.
Or did you knock off?
29 will go with 30. I might back up and get into that again. Those liquors got me. I'm fascinated by them, I think. Really? No. Yeah, we'll start at 30. I may back up and go into 29 because we haven't really covered it. Yeah, it's talking about, really, if I were to sum that up real quick, don't forget your offerings to God. You know, we don't talk about giving here. When was the last time you heard a sermon on your tithes and your offerings in this place? This would be one place the preacher could have an excuse for. But what it's saying is what you're obligated to give to God, as a Christian, you're obligated to give. Now, if you have pledged to tithe as a Christian, and a Christian is not required to tithe, I shock somebody else. I hear a Christian talk about tithing, then I take them to task and say, are you giving 30%? Because that's what the tithe in the Old Testament was. In many years, it was 30%. Okay? But you see, that went not only for the support of the religious functions, but the poor and the government. That included the taxes. You see? Well, you see, that's something you can't say the tithe was 10%, but they were giving their tenth portions, and it could have been several tenths.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. See, you've been studying ahead on the Chelsea. Uh-huh. Keep studying. He's fascinating as you get into it. It seems like there isn't much there. Yeah. What you give is out of what God has blessed you, and if you're wise as a Christian, you'll give as God has given to you. You'll give abundantly. I have never met anybody who could say they outgave God. Now, I don't mean that as a sales talk. I don't mean it as a sales talk. Yeah, but I wouldn't give with that motive of getting more out of God, you see. And yet, you can hear preachers say, well, you send me X number of dollars and I guarantee God will give it to you back 10 times. Well, God may give it back 10 times. But if you're going to give with a motive of getting it back 10 times, that's an investment. I'm going to give God $10, I want 100. When I get that 100, I'm going to give him 50, I want 500. See, that doesn't work. Forget it. Okay? No. No, you give as God has led you, and I love that little church out there and the way it's set up. And God has not hurt this church on that basis. He simply hasn't. Yeah. Really, see, it comes to the firstborn son. The firstborn son was to be, this is one of the hints of it, was to be given to God's service, was to be dedicated to the Lord, or to be bought back with a price. It would be redeemed, and that was included in that verse. All right, let's close with a word of prayer.